And what we're going to do is to, we'll have something on George MacDonald now, and then we'll probably have some more later. We're also going to talk about Solzhenitsyn. And I'm not fully prepared for him either, because I've just enrolled in a course on him. Maybe I'll do better in the course as a result of this. But we've often talked about him here, and Carol and I will be talking about him. And then we're going to do something with the Lifestylers. Lifestylers, is that? That's what we call them.
Yeah.
And then I might do something on Saturday about animals. And then I'm going to do something, I think it's Saturday night, called Hang In There. I need it. And whenever I stand up to give a Vespers, it's addressed to myself, and you can listen. And I need that very badly now, but I won't tell you why until Saturday night. If I can hold out that long. Now, how did I come on to George MacDonald? And for most of you, in fact, one of you said, I just love Holden, and I like to come to Holden, and it's and what I pray for are avalanches and that happen after I get there to keep me from coming out. And she says, and I think expresses the view of many people, that one of the great things of Holden is that we start people reading. And she felt, she said, I feel so illiterate, but I don't feel illiterate now because, for example, you're going to talk about Solzhenitsyn, yes. Well, I've read all of Solzhenitsyn. Well, that's one up on me by quite a few. So she'll have to be in on the sessions too. Okay? And and then I said, what about George MacDonald? Oh, she says, there you go again. How did we come on to him? It's a very interesting story. And it goes back to a day like today. It was just almost the exact day like today, probably almost the same date, when we had the small lay seminar, and Gilberg took Al Rognes and Nora Rognes and myself and a few other people for a hike to Heart Lake. And you remember it. We drove up to the wilderness area, and then we went up. And I felt sorry for Al Rognes. I thought he couldn't take this hard hike. So I kind of paced myself, and we hung back, and then you folks went on up to the lake. We just, around the corner, we could see the beautiful Heart Lake. But the other reason that I kind of hung back, not only that I felt sorry for Al Rognes, but that I wanted to talk to him. He's a fantastic person, and we were talking about C.S. Lewis and about George MacDonald. And many of you know that Al Rognes, who was president of the Luther Theological Seminary until he retired quite recently from it, he didn't really retire, but he's a great friend of Holden Millage. But he talked of his son Paul, how he had been to see C.S. Lewis when he was an Oxford scholar. And he then told me about, recounted his death, and which was sudden and very tragic. And he said that this introduced him to George MacDonald. And he was very impressed with George MacDonald, because on his body, on his crushed body, there were these poems of George MacDonald. And so he, in memory of this occasion, Al Rognes sent me this little book called George MacDonald, an anthology edited by C.S. Lewis. And it's been pretty much a constant companion of myself, mine, ever since, except it was an earlier version. It was all worn out, and you see this one's pretty well gone. I've, and
He gives his good ones away.
Yes, yeah, so she has one of those I gave away. It's hardback. But I have a weak back, so I take everything as light as I can. I find out my mind is sort of weak, too, but it slipped. And so that served to introduce me to him. And C.S. Lewis was introduced to George MacDonald early in his life. C.S. Lewis, who is one of the patron saints of Holden Village, and you must read him if you haven't. I think George MacDonald, after today, will also be a patron saint of Holden Village. And C.S. Lewis said of the three-volume Unspoken Sermons by George MacDonald, "My own debt to this book is almost as great as one man can owe to another." And I'd like to just read a little bit about his meeting of another book of his. In making this collection, that is, this book now, what C.S. Lewis did in this book was to go through a lot of the writings of George MacDonald. Of course, he didn't know George MacDonald because George MacDonald was born in 1824 and died in 1905. At about age 81. And he and C.S. Lewis only spoke to one person who knew him. Most of his knowledge of George MacDonald was based on a book that I've been trying to get out of our library, in which I saw for the first time 10 minutes ago, and I haven't looked inside the covers because Mary wouldn't let me use it. She,
I don't trust you.
She don't trust me, that's right. And she has it there. And that book is a book of about George MacDonald and his wife by one of his children. How many did you count on this picture? Here's a picture of his children and himself and his wife. And there's a whole passel of them here. I don't know, how many did you count? John counted them. Wasn't it 11 or something?
11.
Was it? And so in this collection, he says, in making this collection, I was discharging a debt of justice. I have never concealed the fact that I regarded him as my master. Indeed, I fancy I have never written a book in which I did not quote from him. And C.S. Lewis wrote, 41 books. But it has not seemed to me that those who have received my books kindly take even now sufficient notice of the affiliation. And if you, as grandparents, have never given your children the Narnia series that starts out with The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, and all of those, or read some of his other fantasies, and don't know it, a lot of his ideas are really taken from... I mean, he got his ideas for a lot of this from George MacDonald. Honesty drives me to emphasize it, that he really owes this debt. And even if honestly did not, well, I am a Don, and source hunting is perhaps in my marrow. They're always looking for things. It must be more than 30 years ago that I bought, almost unwillingly, for I had looked at the volume on that bookstall and rejected it on a dozen previous occasions, the Everyman edition of Fantasties. And she has it right here.
That's so, not C.S. Lewis's edition, I'm sorry to say, but this is the Everyman edition.
Yeah.
I didn't realize that that's the one you bought.
Yeah. A few hours later, I knew that I had crossed a great frontier. I had already been waist-deep in Romanticism, and likely enough at any moment to flounder into its darker and more evil forms, slithering down the steep descent that leads from the love of strangeness to that of eccentricity and thence to that of perversity. Now, Fantasties was romantic enough in all conscience, but there was a difference. Nothing was at that time further from my thoughts than Christianity, and I therefore had no notion what this difference really was. I was only aware that if this new world was strange, it was also homely and humble. And if this was a dream, it was a dream in which one at least felt strangely vigilant, that the whole book had about it a sort of cool morning innocence, and also quite unmistakably a certain quality of death, good death. What it actually did to me was to convert, even to baptize, my imagination. That's what Carol quoted for me just a few minutes ago. He said, that's what Phantastes did to him. It baptized his imagination. It did nothing to my intellect, nor at any time to my conscience. Their turn came far later, and with the help of many other books and men. But when the process, and some women too, and shame on him.
Huh? He gave Dorothy Sears a lot of credit, though, in the essay
later.
We just read with... No, we read with the Lifestylers, and
yeah.
I just read.
Yeah.
So I'm not going to give him up.
Okay. But he was unmarried when he wrote this. He did not marry till very late in life. But when the process was complete, by which, of course, I mean when it had really begun, I found that I was still with MacDonald and that he had accompanied me all the way, and that I was now at last ready to hear from him much that he could not have told me at the first meeting. Because as George MacDonald says, and it's one of my laws that I have adopted, I have 18 laws, I keep adding to them, but it states this: you can't tell people what they need to know because they want to know something else. But in a sense, what he was now telling me was the very same that he had told me from the beginning. There was no question of getting through to the colonel and throwing away the shell. No question of a gilded pill. The pill was gold all through. The quality which had enchanted me in his imaginative works turned out to be the quality of the real universe, the divine, magical, terrifying, and ecstatic reality in which we all live. I should have been shocked in my teens if anyone had told me that what I learned to love in Phantastes was goodness. But now that I know, I see there was no deception. The deception is all the other way around, in that prosaic moralism which confines goodness to the region of law and duty, which never lets us feel in our face the sweet air blowing from the land of righteousness, never reveals that elusive form which, if once seen, must inevitably be desired with all but sensuous desire, the thing more gold than gold. It is no part of my aim to produce a critical text of MacDonald. And then he goes on to explain this. But that's the impact that this writer had on C.S. Lewis, who is certainly one of the great spokesmen for Christianity in this century, really, and has come to be appreciated more after his death than even during life. He was sort of the moving force behind the Inklings, which was a group of people who got together who were very interested in Christian imagination. And some of you have been here before. You'll remember the sessions that Mary had on Christian imagination several years ago. And it was one of these falls, only it was an unusual fall, in which we had a lot of rain. And this rain, and we had some Missouri Synod pastors here, and they were meeting here, and we had Christian imagination over there, and never the twain should meet. No, I shouldn't say that. And we were over there. A person who came into the village at that time, and I just thought of it now, Mary, recalling that session on Christian imagination, it was a cute little guy. He had just quit his university in Long Island, and he had been hiking up on the Cascade Trail for many weeks, and he got wet, and it got snow up there. So he came into the village and asked if he couldn't take a shower. And we certainly acknowledged he needed a shower. Take one if you need one. That's what the weatherman tells you when you call him up. How about a shower? He said, take one if you need one. Well, I don't know how that got in there, but But he then asked what was going on here. I remember I had quite a conversation with him because these kind of people attract me because they're characters too. And so I found out, you know, what makes this guy tick. And he was on his way. He was through with the teaching school, and he was going to go down and float some of the rivers in Florida, and then he was going to sort of sail around the world. I don't know if he made it. But he asked what was going on here. And I told him. And at that time we were discussing death too. We had a very interesting session on death. He said that didn't especially appeal to him, but we told him what we were talking about, imagination and some of that. And that kind of appealed to him. And so he showed up at this session that Mary was leading. And he was sitting very benignly in the front row, and the wives of the Missouri pastors were there. And I think a few Missouri pastors broke ranks and came over. And Mary thought that this was one of them. And then after the session, he came up and talked to her. And what did he say? You remember what he said?
No, but he didn't talk to me. I still thought he was...
I remember what he said.
Well, you better... They better say what Leo said.
No, you remember it. Because he's got...
He said, actually, he was a PhD in theology. And he says, he was Jewish.
Yeah.
And he says, my college never believed this. He said, they'll think that I lost my mind up there in the Cascades. He said, I have never heard a more exciting lecture in my life. And he says, when it's on the... And he says, not just on the imagination, but the Christian imagination, and the Christian imagination in children's stories.
He was an agnostic Jew. So that's part of the background for this. Now George MacDonald. He had an unusual relationship with his father. Does his son go into that? So you can enlarge on this. So you're going to enlarge. I'll just go by my memory because I was going to prepare this tomorrow.
Alan, do you want me to lend you the book?
It'd be too late.
You know too much.
Tell some of the stories you wrote just offhand so they get it captured, because everybody here has read some of the stories.
All right. On Lilith. Lilith is a book that you should read, and to tell you the quality of it, one of our children is named Karen. She's the reader in the family. When she was very small, we said, Karen, you cannot read more than 3 books a day. That's what we, and finally we had to cut her down to 1. And she is now, she works in a children's library, but she reads other books too. But she, it wasn't long ago that I was visiting her in American Lake, and she had Lilith there. And I said, how are you doing with Lilith? And she says, well, usually Karen just sits down and reads a book. She says, Lilith is the kind of a book that you don't sit down and read at all. It's so good, you savor it, and you read just a little bit, and you ration yourself. That's how she felt about this book. And I think she's still reading it. Although she might be through, because I got one in the mail the other day, so maybe she finished it. Knowing her, she probably would not buy 2. If she listens to this tape, I take that back. In Back of the North Wind, in Back of the North Wind, every child should read that, shouldn't it? And every adult. And the rest of his books, pardon?
The Little Light Princess.
Oh, The Little Light Princess. And there's 2 volumes of this, The Gifts of the Child Christ. They're fairy tales and stories for the childlike. And it's in 2 volumes, and you have it in the library here.
And also in the bookstore.
And there's a picture of him.
We sold 75 double copies.
We sold 75 double volumes this summer.
Yeah, they didn't fully appreciate him in his time, and they really caught on. I've tried to get several students in literature who were working on a PhD to do George MacDonald. And I've come close on a couple, but they haven't gotten there yet.
Oh, they will now.
I think they will, because he's getting sort of, you know, it's the end thing, see. All right. Now, his relations with his father. Most of us, when we grow up, although I guess I can appreciate it too, because I'll give you part of the thing I was thinking about with you. I love my father very much, and he was gone from home so much. And he was in logging. And he'd leave on Sunday night. And then he wouldn't come back till either Friday night, for Saturday night for a long time, because in the old days, you know, he'd work 6 days a week. And then he'd come back on the farm on Sunday, Saturday night. We always, that was a great event. Saturday nights are still great. Sunday nights are still sad for me. That's kind of strange, isn't it? But Sunday nights are usually very sad for me. Even now. But many children rebel against their father. They have bad experiences with their father as they grow up and exert themselves. They want to beat you in ping pong, and they want to beat you in everything, you know. I always quit while I was still ahead. And then they always wanted to race me in the swimming pool. And so I developed a stroke. An unusual stroke that none of my children could beat me at. You lay on your back, put your feet up. You got to keep your feet out of the water, and then you pedal that way so you can see where you're going. All other strokes, you know, you can't see where you're going. So this is a great stroke, and they could never beat me in this. So that's a tip for you on how to get along with your children. But so I'm still doing that stroke. And they'd cheat and do all kinds of things, but they could never beat me. But he was not in competition with his father. He had unusual rapport with him. I think truly remarkable, and you can enlarge on this, but I just, these are just a few of the things that I gleaned. And the strange part of it is, which is hard to believe, is that he could never recall that his father didn't grant every request that he made of him. And I look back on my children, and I they can't say that. And there's a reading in here that sort of reflects that. If I can find it, and it might be. Somewhere in this book, yeah. And there is a communion with God that asks for nothing, yet asks for everything. He who seeks the Father more than anything he can give is likely to have what he asks, for he is not likely to ask amiss. And I think this gives some insight into it, that probably his relations with his father was of such nature that maybe his requests were reasonable, that he did not ask amiss. It is interesting, too, in this regard, that he had a lot to say about a lot of things, including prayer. And he says, even such as ask amiss may sometimes have their prayers answered. The father will never give the child a stone that asks for bread, but I am not sure that he will never give the child a stone that asks for a stone. If the father say, my child, that is a stone, it is no bread, and the child answer, I am sure it is bread, I want it, may it not be well that he should try his bread? In single quotation marks. His father was at the same time what I regard as a Christian Scotsman, who was hard, tender, and had a great sense of humor all at the same time. It was sort of a trilogy for him. And so he grew up to enjoy life which he certainly did in spite of abject poverty. His father was a truly remarkable person, and I may refer to some of this on Saturday if we talk about my life with the animals, but his father had to have his leg amputated above the knee, and of course there was no chloroform. He did it without ether, and in those days what you do is take a big shot of whiskey, but he refused to take the whiskey and did it and took it without really saying more than whiff as they just started the cut. And he had at one point, they were the very ugly crowd was burning his father in effigy, and he got up before this crowd and made light. He made a very unusual joke about himself, and the ugly mob just evaporated because he told this very fantastic joke on himself. He taught his son how to ride a horse bareback before he'd ever let him touch a saddle. He however advised him, and he didn't take this advice, did he? Give up the fruitless game of poetry. Of course, a few of his poems he should have probably given up before he wrote them, but there's some really good ones too. And he also exacted a promise out of his son at the age of 23 that he would never, that he would leave tobacco alone forever, which he did. His father objected to grouse shooting because of the cruelty of it. In fact, it was unusual for this time that his father, and also his own sensitivity too, that I think was carry over from his father, that he had this compassion for animals. And this was very unusual at that time. And it's evident in one of his writings here, which I'd like to read for you. I have my favorite ones marked here, and this is one that I marked early. The bliss of the animals lies in this, that on their lower level, they shadow the bliss of those few at any moment on the earth who do not look before and after and pine for what is not, but live in the holy carelessness of the eternal now.
Read that last line, it's one of the great lines.
Yeah, but live in the holy carelessness of the eternal now. And I was sharing something on the way up, wasn't I? On sacred idleness. A dear friend of mine from Richland. And we were having quite a discussion on the way up. And we discussed on how we were raised. You got to be busy all the time. If you're not busy with something, then you're not really doing what you should be doing. And I recalled then, for her and myself, because I need this very much, since I'm presently working at about 100 hours a week, work is not always required of a man, and I would add also a woman. There is such a thing as sacred idleness, the cultivation of which is now fearfully neglected. Now, he was a very bright young student, and he enrolled at King's College at the age of about 16. And 2 years later, he took a job, I suppose for the summer, in a great house in northern Scotland. And he was cataloging this library. And this event, when he was, I guess, 18 years old, impressed him forever. And it haunts almost, I guess, his books all the way through his life. This library event, he had a great made a great impression on him. He was raised a Calvinist, although his family was, but his father was hardly a Calvinist. But his history was one of escape from theology, in this theology in which he was brought up. I think we can safely say that. But unlike most who did this, he was not resentful of it. He was hewn out of this rock, but he always sort of respected the rock in a way. And in fact, it was hard for him to be really wheeled off with anybody. He didn't hold a lot of resentment. He had little guile in him. Even for his grandmother, who was a real witch, I think. She burned his uncle's fiddle because she said it was of the devil. But even in relating this, she came off pretty well. And instead of saying to know all is to forgive all, he said, to forgive is to know. But even in relating this, she came off pretty well. And instead of saying to know all is to forgive all, he said, to forgive is to know. He who loves sees. And he entered King's College at 16. And that was in, and by 1950, then he was 26 years old. 1850, he took a call. He took a call into a parish that was, it was racked with dissent. And before 2 years were out, the deacons decided to, he was heretical. For two reasons, chiefly, because he believed in the future state of probation for heathen, which was bad enough, but the second one was even worse. He was tainted with German theology. And instead of just tying the can on him and saying, you know, why don't you try a Chelan or something, they said, they didn't say anything, they just cut his pay. He was at that time being paid 160 or something pounds a year. But they didn't quite figure him right. He said, well, he'd just have to try to live on less. And by this time he has a wife, and I suppose one in the oven at least, or maybe, you know. Yeah, he had a child a year. And maybe by this time he's got two, because after about a year of this, he just couldn't take it anymore. He just couldn't. I mean, he was always one step from starvation. How did they say this? He was always close to literal starvation. But he was always delivered. At the last moment, there'd be deliverance, which agnostics attribute to chance and Christians to providence. But he always managed to make it through. And then he went on a lecture tour, an odd job thing, and preaching here and there and writing like crazy. And one of the things he wrote was... it was a collection of poems which is now called The Diary of an Old Soul, and it's 6-7 line poetry, one for every day of the year.
It's a sonnet.
Sonnet, that's right.
14 lines.
Only they cut it in half. And
no, aren't there 8 lines first and then 6 at the end?
I'll read you the one for today. September the 25th, is it? Lord, losing in me the hold of visible things, help me to walk by faith and not by sight. I would through thickest veils and coverings see into the chambers of the living light. Lord, in the land of things that swell and seem, help me to walk by the other light supreme, which shows thy facts behind man's vaguely hinting dream. And that's for today. Well, I think what they did, he probably had 162,
and they made him into 65.
Yeah, yeah, or something. So that's the Diary of an Old Soul, which you can borrow while you're here. And now, I'm going to, I think, Mary, you ought to tell us now more about his later life and his in how he enjoyed things and he although he didn't really have much, he appears to have been a very sunny, playful man, deeply appreciative of all things that were beautiful and also delicious things that money can buy, and he could really appreciate these. And I always recall at this point how Carol said that as he was getting ready to go to the mission fields, he practiced by sleeping on the floor. But now tell us what you think about it.
Well, I had to sleep on that cement all those years in the Japanese. I thought, why didn't I sleep in bed when I had a chance?
That's right. And that's George MacDonald's philosophy. And of course, he was content to do also without them when he had to, which was a lot of the time. And it also goes on to say it's perhaps significant and certainly touching that his chief recorded weakness was a Highland love of finery. And he was all his life hospitable as only the poor can be. So now I think you, Mary, you take up George MacDonald.
You keep on. You're doing fine.
No, I want you to know. Now tell us, and then I will be picking out some of these really great things that he wrote that'll give you a real feel for some of the things he said.
We've been talking in lifestyle about the fact that imagination is an important and essential part of the Christian life. That it's impossible to have language without imagination. After all, you don't know what I am saying. If I describe an experience to you, unless you can imagine something about the words that I'm using, and also somehow that you are able to project with your imagination into those words so that you can in a way feel that experience too. For example, many people will say, I never knew what fear was until I heard that avalanche come down. Well, you've used the word fear for years with your imagination, but you never really knew what it was until something made fear an actualization for you. This is what the imagination does. It does allow you to project into something that you perhaps don't already know. I would like to tell you something that I never imagined. I never imagined that, how many years ago is it since you came? First time?
12 years ago.
That,
12 years ago, I would never have imagined that this weekend would still be taking place, a kind of lay seminar, which we had dreamed about. I not only had very little imagination, but I had not even one drop of faith. Carol is crazy enough to have both imagination and faith, so he assumed that there were enough lay people in the country and around the area who would be interested in something happening up here in terms of a conversation about theology and ideas related to Christianity. As I say, I had very little hope and no imagination. And we were riding up on the boat that first weekend, and I saw this person sitting over in the corner with a green fatigue outfit on and a hat, and he looked very much like a bird, and he had some fishing poles, and he was sitting there with glasses on and was looking at something like this, you know. And I thought, I bet that's the only person, that's the kind of person we'll probably have at the lay seminar.
You were right.
I was right, right. I was right. But what I was wrong about was, you know, stupid me, you know. I had a typical middle-class female approach that, you know, everybody who goes to things like that have got to look with it, you know, bright-eyed and bushy-tailed, only not looking lean and intelligent and hungry, but, you know, really, you know, everything at their disposal, and not the garbage disposal either. And lo and behold, Leo came. This was the bird man that was sitting in the corner of the Lady of the Lake that day. I didn't realize what a bird man he was. You know, he is crazy about birds, besides being crazy about animals. But he was one that came, and Esther Ellingsburg came, and I didn't recognize her either because she worked all the time. She came up and she understood that the lay seminar was supposed to be, we were supposed to work and we were supposed to take part in the discussions. And she never was told when the discussions were because she was working on an inventory in the kitchen all the time. And Esther is here and she comes back every year too, and she doesn't just work now. She gets to the discussions, thank goodness, because she's a great gal. And besides that, she puts in 100% time working as well. There were two other people here that year. That was Al and Nora Rognes and Carol and I. We were discussing Kierkegaard's Works of Love. And that was the first lay seminar. Now, we've had them for 12 years ever since, and not least because of the fact that Leo has been a staunch supporter. And I will say that that we've had two and three people, and some years we've had six, and some years we've had 10, and then some years, particularly the year when we discussed mysticism and the occult, then we had an avalanche of people, all of which goes to show that one never knows, you know, what's going to be drifting in on people. But this year we didn't announce a subject because Tilika was going to be here next week, and we didn't really feel that we could operate a big lay seminar the weekend beforehand. So we just sort of underplayed it and thought, well, people can come or not as they want to, and we'll be glad to discuss George MacDonald and the whole realm of the Christian imagination, in which he is sort of the patron saint. So this is why Leo has introduced him this afternoon, and why we will also be talking about Solzhenitsyn and in terms of the present day use of the imagination by a Christian who is writing to our particular problems in our particular day. The one thing that I would like to say about George MacDonald is that I think it's important what Leo mentioned about his loving finery. He he loved to wear a Highland, his Highland shorts, you know, the Highlanders, where they got all dressed up, wore kilts, you know, and put on their fringes and their bagpipes and their little hats, and he loved that. And I think perhaps this is one of the reasons he enjoyed so much having amateur theatricals, and eventually developed a real theatrical company out of his very large family, so that they were able to make enough money putting on theatricals so that they could live part of the time in the in Italy or some southern clime where they had a little bit pleasanter climate and they didn't have to pay for so much heat. But part of the dramas were written by him, some of them were dramas that they adapted from Shakespeare or some traditional writer. I was talking to Leo about MacDonald and about the writers who were involved in all these works of the imagination. And we discussed this too in the lifestyle discussions that we've had on the Christian imagination the last 2 weeks. I think the mistake that we have about understanding the imagination is that we all think that the imagination is something that comes out of the airy nothing, you know, that it's just anywhere and you just dream up something because you've got so many wonderful ideas in your head that they can, you know, they can just happen. But the kind of imagination, that imaginative works that kept on being productive and keep on recreating and refreshing us today, are works by people who have been fed in their adult life, in their educated life, by some really good writers. In other words, these people read Shakespeare, they read Milton, they read the works of the 18th century poets, and Wordsworth and Coleridge and so on, people, and George MacDonald was deeply influenced by some German writing that was I think is what they were the people were referring to when they talked about German theology. It wasn't Lutheran theology, I'm afraid. It may have been. I know he had some good impact from German theology in terms of Lutheranism, because he certainly understood substitution and he understood the happy exchange. But he was also influenced by Novalis and Tieck and some of the Romanticists, who were rather far out, I would say. I much prefer George MacDonald to the people that he was taking some of his inspiration from. So.
Or probably even going back in their young adult, or even in their younger days, the kind of reading and books they were exposed
mm-hmm,
to. That's,
mm-hmm.
that's so very important to get this foundation of scholarship and I know in our family,
mm-hmm.
who's the imaginative one? Well, mm-hmm. it's Karen mm-hmm. with all this reading and many of them, many times that
mm-hmm.
she's read them. And to really work at it. And I think that's the impact. For example, one of the better things that happened to George MacDonald was that he was in that great house.
Mm-hmm.
I think he'd had
exactly.
an exposure before.
Right.
But I'm sure he was, night and day, was mm-hmm. reading these many books.
He was.
Some of which he had never been exposed,
mm-hmm.
Never probably seen before.
That's right.
And you can't, you have to have a basis for this. You're saying you can't get
well, it isn't just...
It
isn't just, it isn't as if you were sort of cultivating something that, with nothing to feed on. And and I think that this is what a lot of people think when they talk about the imagination. They think it's a substitution for something else, that it takes too much work to bother about that. I'll just imagine something.
They knew the Old Testament too, and God sent
exactly.
Mary Harlan in order to get the news
right.
around.
Yeah.
They had TV or radio, and a prophet, Mary Harlan, that any traveling salesman didn't know what she was. And a prophet gets taken in. Or
right.
Isaiah, that gets attention, runs naked for 3 years. And he's a prince, you know, in the court. And he's upper class, and here he's running around naked, you know, gets a little attention.
Right.
Or Jeremiah.
Running the yoke.
You could do anything in your common life without being busted by Jeremiah. No wonder they stuck him down a cesspool plant.
That's right.
You need your morning march. You couldn't hitch up your oxen. You couldn't put on your underwear. Jeremiah's all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
And then that idea of imagination that just clothed your whole reality with God. is what they caught. And
that's
they
right.
Brought that in. Mm-hmm. But I'm just saying, I got one great idea to the audience we're talking. I want to
good.
Share
he got an idea.
Can you all hear him?
He got an idea.
Well, no, but I think it's worthy of thinking yep. about a little. Yep. The reason why we don't use our imagination is because we're scared that if we use our imagination, we'll really be scared. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
I think that's why we do. It hit me, I turned it down. And that's what Herb always just saved me. You know, when I wouldn't get scared when the Japanese were starting bombs, so does it trouble you to have imagination? You'd be scared. It's true, I never imagined one of them hitting me, you know?
Yeah.
It might hit somebody else, but not me. The sun always shines on me because I'm a Norwegian. But they all got a little of it. My forebears got a little of it. God's got to pay me back for some of the United all over here. But I think a lot of people don't because they're scared. And I think the way we let ourselves in on it is to, like this. This is a new material. It's a brand new material that lets you see yourself in it. It's three-dimensional. It's crazy. You know, some of this new stuff has just come out with. I don't know what it's called, really.
Mylar.
It's called Mylar. And you're in it, you see? You get in here and you're there, you know? As lavishly as only God can. And you can't take yourself out of it. And it's like a great Catholic retreat. Manuel says, when you go to retreat, you can't be too presumptuous in applying the God's promises to you. You get into that, and suddenly your imagination starts to explode. You're in it, you see? It's
that's great. That is. That really is. I didn't realize
that. And then you don't have to be scared. And if you aren't scared, your imagination can go. But you're really scared to let your imagination go, because then you're afraid you'll really be scared. And it's true. A lot of people that have imagination without faith are
that's right.
suicidal.
Yeah, that's true. But I would, I think that this happens too, because how many of you have watched a child recently, really watched them? Now that doesn't mean you haven't just seen them, but watched them. And you know, they do things continually out of their imagination. They're always pretending. You know, and you know, now you've got to be careful. You know, can't pretend all the time. You know, you've got to be sure what's lying and what's truth. But you know, a child does have a spontaneous kind of creative life of the imagination. Now, what happens to it? You know, that's a question. What happens to it? Where does it go? Where did we lose it? Got lost. Because most of us have a hard time recovering it. But the recovery of it is important. It's important because, as Carol said, the whole Old Testament is full of the kind of thing that these people fed on. But, you know, did Jesus have an imagination? I asked the kids in the lifestyle, if Jesus had an imagination, do you know? What do you think? You can't answer.
I want to quote James Luther.
Can't answer.
I want to quote James Luther.
You can quote him afterwards, but just a minute. I just wondered if anybody, does anybody have any ideas on that? Do you think Jesus had an imagination?
I always thought of him having a little smirk on his face as he turned the water into wine.
Maybe not a smirk, but a smile.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And as he said, go up and take it to the master, you know, let him taste it now.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I can.
Right. What's a concrete evidence of his imagination that we have, you know, right in front of us if we open the Gospels? The parables, you know, what are they? Sermon texts. But, you know, they did have an original meaning. They're an imaginative story that Jesus tells, just like what happened in the Old Testament. These are stories that tell the same truths.
Think of Einstein. What he said, that he didn't want to read the Gospels, and he refused to read the Gospels because he overwhelmed it, because it was so overpowering for his imagination that he couldn't resist them, and therefore he refused to read them, because as a Jew he'd be captured by them. He just had to desist from reading them. James Luther Adams was a Unitarian, just finished teaching at Harvard once, said to me how shocked he was when that Jesus should be left out of the history of philosophy books. Because he said, after all, the best mind is known by its image-creating power. And Plato's got a couple of images, Kierkegaard's got a few more, but Jesus never opens up his mouth well. Every word, bang, every word. There's not a dull word once. And those are just those remembered words.
And that's why we remember, you know, the lost sheep. Everybody knows about the lost sheep. Everybody knows about the lost coin. I mean, you know, they just ring bells all the time in you. Well, that's just to guarantee a little bit the background for George MacDonald, that because he is an imaginative writer and because he does, you know, project into this world of the imagination, that does not mean that he is somehow deceiving you away from the truth of the Christian gospel or the meaning of Jesus Christ in your relationship to him. If it doesn't undergird it and strengthen it and give you new insights into it, then you shouldn't read him. You should read something else. Because he's not everybody's cup of tea. But certainly, he's somebody that you should take a chance with. Okay?
I may say that the great divorce in which he occurs, this particular novel, C.S. Lewis, was the big buster-upper for my son in his first parish this last year. It was the thing that broke things up and got people really excited and started talking and really thinking about themselves and Jesus Christ, and their own present direction, and their own life, and their own value or order in their own life. And this is George MacDonald speaking, remember, in the finale of The Great Divorce. Just that one book just exploded for his parish, which is a rural parish, northwestern North Dakota. But like he says, a leisure parish. They've got lots of leisure. The fellows have air conditioning and tractors, and they work 5 months a year, and the other 7 months a year, they've got some time to get excited about The Great Divorce.
Great.
Advice around here, your life's already become close.
I'll read you just a few. You mentioned the wine one, and he had something to say about that. At the prayer of his mother, he made room in his plans for a thing she desired. It was not his wish then to work a miracle, but if his mother wished it, he would. He did for his mother what for his own part he would rather have left alone. Not always did he do as his mother would have him, but this was a case in which he could do so, for it would interfere nowise with the will of his father. The son then could change his intent and spoil nothing. So I say, can the father, for the son does nothing but what he sees the father do. It's kind of an interesting aspect of it. And then he, on intercessory prayer, he says this: and why should the good of anyone depend on the prayer of another? I can only answer with the return question: why should my love be powerless to help another? And then God and death. All that is not God is death. And then he also has something to say about sex. One of the great goods that come of having two parents is that the one balances and rectifies the motions of the other. No one is good but God. No one holds the truth or can hold it in one and the same thought but God. Our human life is often, at best, but an oscillation between the extremes which together make the truth. Which I thought was rather interesting. Now, if the flowers were not perishable, if the flowers were not perishable, we would cease to contemplate their beauty, either blinded by the passion for hoarding the bodies of them, or dulled by the commonplaceness that the constant presence of them would occasion. To compare great things with small, the flowers wither, the bubbles break, the clouds and sunsets pass, for the very same holy reason. for which the Lord withdrew from his disciples and ascended again to his Father, that the Comforter, the Spirit of Truth, the soul of things might come to them and abide with them, and so the Son return and the Father be revealed. And I think that's enough for now.
We always have to discuss each one, don't you? So you
yeah.
Linger,
yeah.
Like that oscillation between extremes. It's interesting, another great layman that we never deal with up here, from the Catholic tradition, we have to, is Baron von Hugo. And that's his point, that truth is only held in its polarities. And Archbishop sort of liked him very much. He called him the lay bishop of the world. But he's an exciting man. Never got, as he said, he never got censored by the Pope because the Pope never bothered with the lady. But the truth exists in the oscillations across the universe.
Yeah.
That's why we say, interesting lecture by Tamer, perhaps tomorrow, that'll be included. He's got a good one on the difference between piety and faith in the arts and in the history of art. That faith lives with two statements, piety only has, always has to have one. And so faith has it, you know, humor and devotion together, continually. But piety's got to squash the humor out so we can be really devout. The difference between faith and the two truths that I gave you, two statements. We'll have some fun with that. Thank you for that.
Yeah, so there's the next time then, and be sure we have Carol here, because we'll take these statements and then discuss each one. I think that's a